This is Maggie Jones in Natural Wonders. I'll be reading again from John Muir's book, The Story of My Boyhood and Youth, which he wrote the year before he died. It was written in 1913 and he died in 1914. He was born in 1838 in Dunbar, Scotland, and he moved at age 11 with his family to the wilds and wilderness of Wisconsin. And he provides such an insight into the landscape of Wisconsin prior to the influx of European settlement. And this chapter is called A Paradise of Birds. If you haven't heard me reading John Muir's stories before, I urge you to look at the archive podcasts at WDRT.org. He wrote marvelous stories about his travels in Alaska, especially one story about traveling with a small dog over a very treacherous glacier that they both barely survived. So here's parts of Chapter 4, Paradise of Birds. Most of the reading today will be his observations on the passenger pigeons. And then at the end today, I'll read Aldo Leopold's talk that he gave at the dedication of the monument to the passenger pigeon at Wyalusing State Park in May of 1947. Back to John Muir. After the arrival of the thrushes came the bobolinks, gushing, gurgling, inexhaustible fountains of song, pouring forth floods of sweet notes over the broad Fox River meadows in wonderful variety and volume, crowded and mixed beyond description as they hovered on quivering wings above their hidden nests in the grass. It seemed marvelous to us that birds so moderate in size could hold so much of this wonderful song stuff. Each one of them poured forth music enough for a whole flock, singing as if its whole body, feathers and all, were made up of music, flowing, glowing, bubbling, melody, interpenetrated here and there with small scintillating prickles and spicules. We never became so intimately acquainted with the bobolinks as with the thrushes, for they lived far out on the broad Fox River meadows, while the thrushes sang on the treetops around every home. The bobolinks were among the first of our great singers to leave us in the fall, going apparently direct to the rice fields of the southern states, where they grew fat and were slaughtered in countless numbers for food. Sad fate for singers so purely divine. He goes on to talk about the red-winged blackbirds, the sweet-voiced meadowlark, the Baltimore oriole with its wonderful hanging nests, and the scarlet tanager glowing like fire amid the green leaves. The loud, clear call of the handsome bobwhites was one of the pleasantest and most characteristic of our spring sounds, and we soon learned to imitate it so well that a bold cock often accepted our challenge and came flying to fight. The young ran as soon as they are hatched and follow their parents until spring, roosting on the ground in a close bunch, heads out ready to scatter and fly. These fine birds were seldom seen when we first arrived in the wilderness, but when wheat fields supplied abundance of food, they multiplied very fast, although oftentimes sore pressed during hard winters when the snow reached a depth of 2 or 3 feet, covering their food while the mercury fell to 20 or 30 degrees below zero. Occasionally, although shy on account of being persistently hunted under pressure of extreme hunger in the very coldest weather when the snow was deepest, they ventured into barnyards and even approached the doorsteps of houses, searching for any sort of scraps and crumbs, as if piteously begging for food. It was a great memorable day when the first flock of passenger pigeons came to our farm, calling to mind the story we had read about them when we were at school in Scotland. Of all God's feathered people that sailed the Wisconsin sky, no other bird seemed to us so wonderful. The beautiful wanderers flew like the winds in flocks of millions from climate to climate in accord with the weather, finding their food, acorns, beech nuts, pine nuts, cranberries, strawberries, huckleberries, juniper berries, hackberries, buckwheat, rice, wheat, oats, corn, in fields and forests thousands of miles apart. I have seen flocks streaming south in the fall so large that they were flowing over from horizon to horizon in an almost continuous stream all day long at the rate of 40 or 50 miles an hour, like a mighty river in the sky, widening, contracting, descending like falls and cataracts, and rising suddenly here and there in huge ragged masses like high splashing spray. How wonderful the distances they flew in a day, in a year, in a lifetime. They arrived in Wisconsin in the spring just after the sun had cleared away the snow and alighted in the woods to feed on the fallen acorns that they had missed the previous autumn. A comparatively small flock swept thousands of acres perfectly clean of acorns in a few minutes by moving straight ahead with a broad front. All got their share, for the rear constantly became the vanguard by flying over the flock and alighting in front, the entire flock constantly changing from rear to front, revolving something like a wheel with a low buzzing wing roar that could be heard a long way off. In summer, they feasted on wheat and oats and were easily approached as they rested on the trees along the sides of the field after a good full meal, displaying beautiful iridescent colors as they moved their necks backward and forward when we went very near them. Every shotgun was aimed at them, and everybody feasted on pigeon pies, and not a few of the settlers feasted also on the beauty of the wonderful birds. The breast of the male is a fine rosy red, the lower part of the neck behind and along the sides changing from the red of the breast to gold, emerald green, and rich crimson. The general color of the upper parts is grayish blue, the underparts white. The extreme length of the bird is about 17 inches, the finely modeled slender tail about 8 inches, and the extent of wings 24 inches. The females are scarcely less beautiful. In the New England and Canada woods, beechnuts were their best and most abundant food. Farther north, cranberries and huckleberries. After everything was cleaned up in the north and winter was coming on, they went south for rice, corn, acorns, haws, wild grapes, crabapples, sparkleberries, and so on. They seem to require more than half of the continent for feeding grounds, moving from one table to another, field to field, forest to forest, finding something ripe and wholesome all the year round. In going south, in the fine Indian summer weather, they flew high and followed one another, though the head of the flock might be hundreds of miles in advance. But against headwinds, they took advantage of the inequalities of the ground, flying comparatively low. All followed the leader's ups and downs over hill and dale, though far out of sight, never hesitating at any turn of the way, vertical or horizontal, that the leaders had taken. Though the largest flock stretched across several states and belts of different kinds of weather. There were no roosting or breeding places near our farm, and I never saw any of them until long after the great flocks were exterminated. I therefore quote from Audubon's and Pokagon's vivid descriptions. "Toward evening," Audubon says, "they depart for the roosting place, which may be hundreds of miles distant. One of the banks of Green River, Kentucky, was over 3 miles wide and 40 long. My first view of it," says the naturalist, "was about a fortnight after it had been chosen by the birds, and I arrived there nearly 2 hours before sunset. Few pigeons were then to be seen, but a great many persons with horses and wagons and armed with guns, long poles, sulfur pots, pine pitch torches, and so on, had already established encampments on the borders. Two farmers had driven upwards of 300 hogs, a distance of more than 100 miles, to be fattened on slaughtered pigeons. Here and there the people employed in plucking and salting what had already been secured were sitting in the midst of piles of birds. Dung several inches thick covered the ground. Many trees 2 feet in diameter were broken off at no great distance from the ground, and the branches of many of the tallest and largest had given way, as if the forest had been swept by a tornado. Not a pigeon had arrived at sundown. Suddenly a general cry arose, 'Here they come!' The noise they made, though still distant, reminded me of a hard gale at sea passing through the rigging of a close-reefed ship. Thousands were soon knocked down by the pole men. The birds continued to pour in. The fires were lighted, and a magnificent as well as terrifying sight presented itself. The pigeons pouring in alighted everywhere, one above the other, until solid masses were formed on the branches all around. Here and there the perches gave way with a crash, and falling destroyed hundreds beneath, forcing down the dense groups with which every stick was loaded. A scene of uproar and conflict. I found it useless to speak or even to shout to those persons nearest me. Even the reports of the guns were seldom heard, and I was made aware of the firing only by seeing the shooters reloading. None dared venture within the line of devastation. The hogs had been penned up in due time, the picking up of the dead and wounded being left for the next morning's employment. The pigeons were constantly coming in, and it was after midnight before I perceived a decrease in the number of those that arrived. The uproar continued all night, and anxious to know how far the sound reached, I sent off a man who, returning 2 hours later, informed me that he had heard it distinctly 3 miles distant. Toward daylight, the noise in some measure subsided. Long before objects were distinguishable, the pigeons began to move off in a direction quite different from that in which they had arrived the evening before, and at sunrise, all that were able to fly had disappeared. Then the authors of all this devastation began their entry amongst the dead. The pigeons were picked up and piled in heaps until each had as many as they could possibly dispose of, when the hogs were let loose to feed on the remainder. And Muir continues, Pokagon, an educated Indian writer, says, I saw one nesting place in Wisconsin, 100 miles long and from 3 to 10 miles wide. Every tree, some of them quite low and scrubby, had from 1 to 50 nests on each. Some of the nests overflow from the oaks to the hemlock and pine woods. When the pigeon hunters attack the breeding places, they sometimes cut the timber from thousands of acres. Millions are caught in nets with salt or grain for bait, and schooners, sometimes loaded down with the birds, are taken to New York where they are sold for a cent apiece. And now I'll read the Aldo Leopold on a monument to the pigeon. And from the Aldo Leopold Foundation website, they say, Aldo Leopold's On a Monument to the Pigeon is widely regarded as one of his most moving essays. The extinct passenger pigeon is the main focus of the essay, but it is also his most thoughtful commentary on the larger issue of human-caused extinctions as a symptom of our tragic relationship with other species. The pigeon had been the continent's most abundant bird until gross overexploitation by 19th-century market hunters pushed the species over the brink. The pigeon's extinction is one of the most tragic episodes in the history of our nation's relationship with nature. The monument Leopold wrote about is the famous Passenger Pigeon Monument that was erected at Wyalusing State Park by the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, which celebrated its 75th anniversary in 2014, during the same year that we commemorate the centennial of the passenger pigeon's extinction in 1914. Leopold spoke these words in May of 1947. We have erected a monument to commemorate the funeral of a species. It symbolizes our sorrow. We grieve because no living man will see again the onrushing phalanx of victorious birds sweeping a path for spring across the March skies, chasing the defeated winter from all the woods and prairies of Wisconsin. Men still live who, in their youth, remember pigeons. Trees still live who, in their youth, were shaken by a living wind. But a decade hence, only the oldest oaks will remember, and at long last, only the hills will know. There will always be pigeons in books and in museums, but these are effigies and images, dead to all hardships and to all delights. book pigeons cannot dive out of a cloud to make the deer run for cover or clap their wings in thunderous applause of mast-laden woods. Book pigeons cannot breakfast on new-mown wheat in Minnesota and dine on blueberries in Canada. They know no urge of seasons. They feel no kiss of sun, no lash of wind and weather. They live forever by not living at all. Our grandfathers were less well-housed, well-fed, well-clothed than we are. The strivings by which they bettered their lot are also those which deprived us of pigeons. Perhaps we now grieve because we are not sure in our hearts that we have gained by the exchange. The gadgets of industry bring us more comfort than the pigeons did, but do they add as much to the glory of the spring? It is a century now since Darwin gave us the first glimpse of the origin of species. We know now what was unknown to all the preceding caravan of generations, that men are only fellow voyagers with other creatures in the odyssey of evolution. This new knowledge should have given us by this time a sense of kinship with fellow creatures, a wish to live and let live, a sense of wonder over the magnitude and duration of the biotic enterprise. Above all, we should, in the century since Darwin, have come to know that man, while now captain of the adventuring ship, is hardly the sole object of its quest, and that his prior assumptions to this effect arose from the simple necessity of whistling in the dark. These things, I say, should have come to us. I fear they have not come to many. For one species to mourn the death of another is a new thing under the sun. The Cro-Magnon, who slew the last mammoth, thought only of steaks. The sportsman who shot the last pigeon thought only of his prowess. The sailor who clubbed the last auk thought of nothing at all. But we who have lost our pigeons mourn the loss. Had the funeral been ours, the pigeons would hardly have mourned us. In this fact, rather than in Mr. DuPont's nylons or Mr. Vannevar Bush's bombs, lies objective evidence of our superiority over the beasts. This monument, perched like a duck hawk on this cliff, will scan this wide valley, watching through the days and years. For many a march it will watch the geese go by, telling the river about clearer, colder, lonelier waters on the tundra. For many an April it will see the redbuds come and go, and for many a May the flush of oak blooms on a thousand hills. Questing wood ducks will search these basswoods for hollow limbs. Golden prothonotaries will shake golden pollen from the river willows. Egrets will pose on these sloughs in August. Plovers will whistle from September skies. Hickory nuts will plop into October leaves, and hail will rattle in November woods. But no pigeons will pass, for there are no pigeons, save only this flightless one, graven in bronze on this rock. Tourists will read this inscription, but their thoughts will not take wing. We are told by economic moralists that to mourn the pigeon is mere nostalgia, that if the pigeoners had not done away with him, the farmers would ultimately have been obliged in self-defense to do so. This is one of those peculiar truths that are valid, but not for the reason alleged. The pigeon was a biological storm. He was the lightning that played between two opposing potentials of intolerable intensity, the fat of the land and the oxygen of the air. Yearly, the feathered tempest roared up, down, and across the continent, sucking up the laden fruits of forest and prairie, burning them in a traveling blast of life. Like any other chain reaction, the pigeon could survive no diminution of his own furious intensity. When the pigeoners subtracted from his numbers and the pioneers chopped gaps in the continuity of his fuel, his flame guttered out with hardly a sputter or even a wisp of smoke. Today the oaks still flaunt their burden at the sky, but the feathered lightning is no more. Worm and weevil must now perform slowly and silently the biological task that once drew thunder from the firmament. The wonder is not that the pigeon went out, but that he ever survived through all the millennia of pre-Babician time. The pigeon loved his land. He lived by the intensity of his desire for clustered grape and bursting beechnut, and by his contempt of miles and seasons. Whatever Wisconsin did not offer him gratis today, he sought and found tomorrow in Michigan or Labrador or Tennessee. His love was for present things, and these things were present somewhere. To find them required only the free sky and the will to ply his wings. To love what was is a new thing under the sun, unknown to most people and to all pigeons. To see America as history, to conceive of destiny as a becoming, to smell a hickory tree through the still lapse of ages, all these things are possible for us, and to achieve them takes only the free sky and the will to ply our wings. In these things, and not in Mr. Bush's bombs and Mr. DuPont's nylons, lies objective evidence of our superiority over the beasts. And that's Aldo Leopold from his talk in 1947 at the dedication of the Passenger Pigeon Monument at Wyalusing State Park. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.